It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new exhibition opens Saturday at City Books IM Gallery that runs through August 24th. Breathe, curated by local multidisciplinary artist Corey Carrington, also known as Grits Capone, shares stories of joy, individuality, and power as framed exclusively by artists of color. One of those participating artists is Patience Lee. Grits Capone, Patience Lee, welcome to the Confluence.
Nice to meet you, Gavin.
Hi.
Grits, I'm going to start with you. The show's title sets a mood right away. How did you decide on Breathe?
I decided on Breathe by talking to Arlen Hess, the owner of the gallery. IAMB is short for iambic pentameter.
Right.
And iambic pentameter are the building blocks of poetry. And in order to tell a story, you have to be able to breathe. So I immediately thought about Breathe, but I also thought about I Can't Breathe in relation to Eric Garner, the victim of police brutality in New York. So I was thinking about, you know, I can't breathe, but then, you know, breathe, you know, when you it's like a maybe like a sigh of relief. But, you know, if you were in a car accident and you made it, or if you thought you were going to get fired one day and you didn't, and you can just take that. You know, at the end of the
breath.
Day. Yeah, deep breath. So that's kind of the inspiration I had behind the name.
Of course, Eric Garner was nearly 5 years ago. 5 years ago this summer, the New York City man was put in a chokehold by a police officer, arresting him for selling single cigarettes on the street. And, of course, Eric Garner died as a result. Grits, a follow-up. The show will display only artists of color. Tell me about that decision.
So Breathe is the second curatorial effort of myself. My first exhibit was Electric Kool-Aid for the Associated Artists of Pittsburgh. And in that show, there were all the artists were great, but none of the artists were black or of African descent. And I just always knew that something that's important to me is telling black/African stories. So the first opportunity I got to where, you know, it would just be me curating artists and picking artists that I wanted to pick. I just decided that I wanted to tell an all black/African story.
Patience, I want to get your thoughts on that, being part of that all black African artist story.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely excited to be a part of it just because I do focus on black work. So I think that, you know, being in my past, being a part of shows where it was like mixed white and black people, I kind of felt like I was kind of like too black, if that makes sense, for the show. Mm-hmm. So it's finally a good chance to finally be a part of something and, you know, just go full force with it, with my blackness, really.
Not stand out in a good way?
I mean, stand out in a good way, of course, because I'm doing something new that I haven't done yet. So that's going to stand out. But like I said, I just want to be able to just be me, like be black. And I feel like that's something that I always have to hold back on. So I'm excited to be a part of an all black show.
Is it more comfortable for you? Is
I wouldn't say comfortable, but I feel like sometimes I do have boundaries. There's I feel like there are like these imaginary boundaries when doing shows, you know, with white and black people.
Mm-hmm. Grits, how important is it to you to elevate the voices of black artists and in particular black women artists?
I think it's very important. The reason I think it's important is because oftentimes I think that we look at genius as being something that's Eurocentric or white. And I think it's very important to push the envelope of introducing the idea that that there is black genius, there's black women genius. And there's especially black genius in Pittsburgh, and that has been coming out of Pittsburgh for a really long time now.
It's there, but it's just not recognized?
I think it's recognized, but it's not recognized on the level that it should be. For example, I was talking to somebody else about this. Everybody knows, or everybody associates Pittsburgh with Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
Yes.
Black and white people. But how many white people know about August Wilson the same way that they know about Andy Warhol? So, you know, I would just say that, like, you know, as for as much white genius, quote unquote, there is coming out of Pittsburgh or historically is known or associated with Pittsburgh, there's black geniuses who are just as prolific and powerful that have been from Pittsburgh.
Patience.
I would agree with that, really. I mean, right. just from, you know, my inspirations, like people like Teenie Harris.
Great photographer.
Yeah, great. That's one of my biggest inspirations. But we don't get that kind of recognition when it comes to the Black artists we have. Like you said, we just get like the Andy Warhols and, you know, they're opening and dedicating museums, but they give like Teenie Harris a little exhibit every once in a while, mm-hmm. you know, so.
We don't have to limit our acceptance of genius, do we?
Yeah, we don't.
It's a wide range. A wide range.
Patience, so how does your work, you mentioned, you know, feeling boundaries sometimes yeah. in other exhibits. How does your work for this exhibition fit into that narrative concept of Breathe?
I would say because of like my recent pattern, like in regards to how I do photography, I usually would do like black and white. I wanted to steer away from like not the, you know, bash that magazine, but I wanted to steer away from like that Essence feel to where it's like when you look in Essence magazine and like the black magazines, you see them wearing like those sultry colors that like they try to pin on black girls as our color undertones and our complementary colors. I wanted to like break out of that and do bright colors that they would probably match with like maybe someone who wasn't black. So that's kind of like what I wanted to do, just something different. Lots of colors. On colored girls, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. So you've given us a little bit of a tease, bright colors, but will you describe your piece a little bit more?
Yeah, so it's pretty much because I'm a photographer, and I do paint and I do digital art as well. So I pretty much do everything. I pretty much, you know, painted on my models. I pretty much took the photos, I directed it, you know, colored backdrops, and then I also painted on them. And then there was this newspaper article I was reading a long time ago about like art gallery anxiety, and I'm big on like incorporating like mental health into my work as well. So. Mm-hmm. I put that on top of like the article about like art gallery anxiety.
Well, how do you incorporate mental health in a piece of art?
So this one was about like the color frequencies. I'm big on like color frequencies, like the music frequencies. That's huge to me. Like it's very imperative. Like you can see a color and feel, you know, some kind of way. So that's kind of what I wanted to pinpoint. Definitely like as an artist, I wear a lot of black. So, you know, I'm just trying to do something new with colors now.
So Grits, how did the show come to be? City Books approached you, is that correct?
That's correct. I would say back in March, I got a DM on Instagram mm-hmm. From Arlen, and she was just saying, hey, you know, I was looking up Northside curators and your name came up, and I was wondering if you would be interested in curating a show. Originally it was in April. But I said that's kind of too short notice for me. I really want to take my time with it. Right. So she said, I have an opening in June. Would you like to do that? And I said, yes. We met. We talked. I love the space. You know, the bookstore is like it's quaint, but it's very powerful with the kind of books that they have. And in the section, the gallery in the back, it was just small enough that I knew that if I got the right amount of artists with, you know, just one piece per artist, that it would be a very powerful show.
So how did you narrow down that work, that one piece per artist, and also the people who would ultimately produce that work?
So what I did was I wrote a curatorial statement, you know, basically saying what Breathe is about. And just to give everybody, the readers or the listeners, background, mm-hmm. Breathe is about telling stories of joy, freedom, power, individuality, through the lens of blackness. So this is, the idea is kind of like, you know, black artists imagining a world where black people are free from oppression.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're here with Breathe curator Corey Carrington, Grits Capone, and also participating artist Patience Lee, who is a mixed media artist. Grits, telling stories through this exhibition, you just mentioned some of the themes of the stories, the joy and the power. Do you feel you've accomplished all that? That's a wide range that you just described.
It is.
Yes.
It's a lot of pressure.
I definitely feel like I have. I feel like I have because there are so many different artists in the show. We have We have mixed media. We have painting. We have performance art. We have audio. You know, I think that's a very important component. We have two DJs who curated the soundtrack. You know, one made a mix and one made a playlist. So having the music playing while people are going to be looking at the artwork is just very impactful.
Patience, does your work that's going to be exhibited, does that reflect one, two, all those qualities that Grits mentioned, from power to joy to happiness to individuality?
At first, I was like, because I actually made this specifically, this work for this show. So I did try to touch every point, you know, and it was a lot of pressure, but I feel like it did. Like I said, breaking out from just being a person who focuses on black colors, that was that freedom piece for me. The color frequency, that was the joy, you know, for me. And then, like I said, I've lived my whole life in a society where they told me what colors match my skin tone and what works best for me. So, you know, just getting away from what society is telling me to do as a black girl.
You obviously know your work.
Yeah.
The show hasn't opened yet. This Saturday goes up. But have you seen the other work?
I haven't seen the other work, but I'm so excited to be a part of this with the artists, because I would definitely say they're my favorite artists. I think it's a great all-star lineup, really, you know, with the artists. I haven't seen their work yet, but I know what they can do.
All right, so I can't ask you this, so I'll ask Grits, what piece might have surprised you the most?
I think... there's a piece by Ali Rose called Immortal that is very powerful. She sent me a couple different pieces, and she said, I think some of these pieces kind of fit into the theme. You have the, you know, the freedom to pick whichever one you want. So when I picked that one, it's a digital illustration, and I think it doesn't really reference blackness per se, but just her experience and her ability to capture her experience visually was just very powerful for me. So that's one of the pieces that stick out.
Patience, I'll put you on the spot. You haven't seen, but who you anticipating seeing?
I would definitely say that I'm anticipating seeing, there's an artist, Aim. I don't know if he's going by Aim or Khalil Malik these days. I'm excited to see his work. He has like a Basquiat feel, and that's my favorite artist. And I'm kind of excited to see what he's going to do and correlate for this show. So he and his work style is a little different. So I'm definitely anticipating seeing that. I would say Caleb Ferguson, just because people would never see us in a show together, honestly. So that's going to be different. Definitely glad to see you did that, Grits. and then C.B. Perry, he's definitely one of my favorite artists in this city. Yeah.
We have just a few minutes left. I mean, artists obviously show their individuality in their work. How do you feel the collected works showcase black life, especially black life free from oppression?
I think that the work shows the possibility and the range of black life. One of the most important things for me was to include the female voice, the voice of the woman. So I believe that the collective work from the women, as far as visual and audio, impacts the work. And I believe that the work from the men in the show was just powerful, too. It's like you can't necessarily look at the work and tell that these are all black artists. But I think that's kind of the point, is like, you know, not necessarily free from being black, but free from having the burden of presenting black work or presenting black art.
And Patience, how do you feel that your story through the work that you're presenting will sort of, you know, fit in to all the other stories?
I mean, that's a hard one to say because, again, I haven't seen their work. But
how do you hope it does?
I hope it fits in, because I hope we just tell like related stories more so. Like he said, I want you to look at my work and say, like, I don't know if this is a black girl or, you know, a white girl who did this work, or a white man, black man who did this work. But like I said, just the colors, they stand out. I chose colors that do. And that's kind of just basically, I want people to feel the emotions and, you know, like the freedom, the joy. I want you to look at my work and feel the freedom and the joy, and that's pretty much what I want my work to say.
To each of you, when people come to see Breathe, what do you hope they will come away with, be talking about as they leave the I Am gallery? Fritz, let's start with you.
I think what I want people to take away the most is to acknowledge humanity. I think that that's one of the biggest problems in society right now is that we don't see the humanity in each other, so it allows us to mistreat each other. So when people come away from the show, I want them to be able to acknowledge humanity.
And patience?
I would honestly have to piggyback off what he said, that acknowledgement piece. I want us to be acknowledged. I want us to put our foot in the doors of being able to, like, break free, get out of that oppression, get out of, you know, what society is telling us to do. So I just want people to see, like, this is, like, kind of what we're doing. We're putting our foot in the door.
Corey Carrington, who goes by Gritz Capone, is a Pittsburgh artist and curator of the upcoming show Breathe. Patience Lee is a participating artist. Breathe opens at the I Am Gallery at City Books in the North Side on Saturday, continues through August 24th. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh staffers say they're not getting a fair wage and that the system lacks in diversity. We'll hear about the steps they're taking towards unionizing. And a state constitutional amendment that would give crime victims stronger standing to sue if certain rights are violated will be on the November ballot in Pennsylvania. Those opposed to the bill say it's not that simple. Coming up, we'll hear from both sides of the debate over the amendment. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Email us at confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, an article is posted in the Pittsburgh Press in 1884 about the rise in female newspaper delivery workers. The newsies, as they were called, were traditionally boys, but as the article notes, many young women took on the role after realizing they could make more money doing that than conventional female occupations at the time. Some boy newsies threatened a strike, but others say they didn't mind the girls out on the streets. This week also marked 100 years since the Pennsylvania legislature ratified the 19th Amendment, granting women the right to vote. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Full and part-time employees with the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh say the system lacks diversity, isn't paying an equitable wage, and doesn't offer benefits that allow workers to live sustainable lives. So they're taking the first step towards unionizing. Julia Menti is a reader advisor at the Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. She spoke at a committee meeting for the United Library Workers on Monday, and she joins us now. Julia, thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why do Carnegie Library employees want to unionize?
Yeah, so over the past year, we have really come together and built this committee to address some of the issues that we see on the job. Some of the main ones that we see are absolutely pay, but also the benefits that our full-time and part-time workers are able to have. And some instances of those would be health care for part-timers, as well as paid sick leave, paid time off, and paid holidays. And also generally for all of our workers to have more of a voice on the job and be able to advocate for ourselves and for our patrons better.
So you want to provide input and have it listened to? Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely, yes. Currently, we do get a lot of opportunities to offer our input, and we're asked for that all the time. But we've observed over many years that that hasn't been the case, that it's really been listened to and enacted in the way that we want to see. We haven't really been able to hold administration accountable to listening to what we have to say as experienced workers.
Can you give a particular example of something you might have suggested that was ignored that might have benefited your patrons?
Yeah, there have been a lot of instances where workers are understaffed and certain branches don't have enough support from staff to be able to really fully service the communities in the way that we want to. And that is something that we haven't really seen turn around. And in fact, we've seen a lot more positions cut than we would like to see.
So some of the grievances, it sounds like, are monetary. Pay, benefits, sick leave or no sick leave. But are there other administrative practices or policies that you have a problem with?
Yeah, so one of the issues that we've identified is that while there is some representation of people of color working in the staff in public-facing positions, such as in the library assistant positions or as clerks, we really have very few administrators, almost none, that are people of color who can share that experience and be mentors for our other workers and also for our community.
So that goes to a hiring practice, does it not, though?
It does, yes, but there are a lot of ways that the community or the library, in fact, could support the community in bringing out people who can be those diverse mentors in our community, and we think that the library could be doing more to make that happen.
19 branches are involved. How many employees are we talking about? All departments?
Yeah, so we're talking about 350 people that would be included in this union, and that would include clerks, library assistants, librarians, and people who do the library support work and help facilitate moving all of the material of the libraries all over the city.
And any holdouts? People say, no, I don't want to be involved in a union. I don't think we should go that route.
Well, overwhelmingly, we have seen a lot of support, and I think a lot of that is due to the fact that Pittsburgh is a union town and Pittsburgh has a really strong history.
Have the grievances been building, and what got the unionizing off the ground, if you would?
Yeah, so what we've seen is, as we're all separated between 19 different branches, we don't often have the opportunity to share our different issues that we see in the workplace. But when people did start coming together, just a few at a time from a few different branches, we started seeing that there are the same issues at every branch. And through doing that, we were able to gain more support as we listened to our coworkers and had these conversations about what we need at work and what we don't currently have.
What impact could this have on the community at large?
Well, I will mention that not only are we the workers of Carnegie Library, but we also are community members. So we can't really separate the two from each other. But what I anticipate is that this will show our community that we're advocating for the benefits that they get from the library. I think having a healthier, happier staff will allow our services to be more enriching and better follow through, more programs, more opportunities for staff to really interact and engage on the level that got us into this work, which is a passion for public service.
Final question. What are your next steps?
Right now, our next steps as the committee are to continue to listen to our coworkers and get as much support as possible. We've also, you know, already started getting a lot of support from the community, and we want to see that continue because this is our fight all together. And this is what will really improve the work that we are able to do and in turn improve the community.
Julia Menti is a reader advisor at the Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In a unanimous vote last week, the state Senate approved Marcy's Law. It's an amendment that would preserve the rights for crime victims in the state constitution, and it now goes to voters as a ballot measure in November. Laurie McDonald is the president and CEO of the Center for Victims. Welcome back to The Confluence, Laurie.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
And on the line is Elizabeth Randall, legislative director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Liz.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning to you. A reminder to our listeners, the effort to pass Marcy's Law began in California about a decade ago. Constitutional amendments on the books in at least 11 states. It was named for Marcy Nicholas, a college student murdered by her former boyfriend back in 1983. Laurie, I want to start with you. Pennsylvania already has a victim rights law. Why do you think a constitutional amendment is necessary?
Well, because victims' rights laws in Pennsylvania are statutory. It's not a constitutional law, which means it can be repealed, it can be changed, so on. I don't think people really understand what it's like for a victim in a courtroom. Very often, victims are there for the very first time. They don't understand the judicial system, and they don't. You know, that's why we exist, so that we can advocate for them and help them, support them through the system. At any rate, in a courtroom, the judge has to be impartial, as we all know. A perpetrator has a public defender, and then the victim is standing there alone, unless we're there with them.
All right. Liz, the ACLU has opposed the amendment as it made its way through two successive legislative sessions. Why so?
So, obviously, this is a nuanced and unfortunately sort of complicated issue with how we oppose this amendment. Look, I want to just at least start out by saying that we are sympathetic and certainly empathetic with the concerns and the frustrations that many victims have had working their way through the process. Our criminal legal system is incredibly burdensome and onerous and complicated. And fortunately for people like Lori that exist to help victims through that process. Our concern at the ACLU is that we believe that many of these issues that Marcy's Law claims to address could be done through statute. So you mentioned Pennsylvania's Crime Victims Act that has many robust protections for victims and includes them along the way in places where they are able to be heard to participate and to be notified of proceedings throughout the process. Our concern is that by attempting to make the rights of victims co-equal to the rights of the accused, those two rights end up running headfirst into one another. That the reason that our Constitution protects so vigorously the rights of the accused is that they're not perpetrators when they're in the courtroom necessarily. They have not been convicted yet. And that there are, you know, our Constitution and our framers certainly imagined and knew very well a system that ran roughshod over the rights of the accused, whether they were guilty or innocent. That in either case, the state has a huge burden to convict someone, to deprive them of life, liberty, or property, and to elevate victims' rights in a way that conflicts with the rights of the accused is a very dangerous precedent to set, and we think is going to cause some significant problems in our criminal legal system.
Lori.
Well, you know, I have great respect for the ACLU and the work that they do, you know, to ensure that we all have our civil liberties, and it's really important. It's certainly important for the accused. And Pennsylvania, I think, does a good job with a lot of legislation, not just for victims, but also for perpetrator sentencing, fairness, and those sort of things. All that being said, you know, this is oftentimes a matter of life and death, too. For example, if a perpetrator asks for a continuance in a case, we had that case here, I can't remember her name, but she was murdered by Cesar, I can't remember his name. Anyway, you know, she wasn't aware of what the system needed to do. Many times, attorneys for perpetrators change the date, change the time, change the venue, whatever they ask for, they get, and the victim's never notified. And in that case, the perpetrator then murdered her.
Is this one of the major differences that victims would be automatically notified of different court proceedings? Liz, is that one of the things that you take away from this proposed amendment?
So, I mean, here's the thing. There, in our current statute, there are several entities that are responsible, depending on where a victim is in the process, that are responsible for notification. So it could start with the Office of OVA, the Office of Victim Advocate and Victim Services. It could be the District Attorney's Office. It could be the Department of Public Welfare. You go on down the line. Those are already in there. Those requirements are there. The problem is that there's not often enough staffing, personnel, or people responsible for doing those notifications. There is nothing in Marcy's Law that provides any additional money, no additional personnel, no additional resources to help those entities that are responsible for the notifications to provide those notifications in a more timely fashion. And worse, it's not clear to me that there's any enforcement mechanism for failure to notify. So if what Lori is saying, We've heard that from victims. There is no question that that is an issue and certainly something that needs to be rectified. But Marcy's Law does nothing on the front end to provide more resources to help those departments who carry that responsibility for notification, nor does it really include any discernible mechanism to enforce that right, even at a constitutional level. So if whoever it was at that point in the process of the case that Lori's describing fails to be notified, there's no recourse.
But it's more about than just failure to notify. It's about the fact that those rights that are afforded to victims can be changed at any time. And when a perpetrator has constitutional rights, this is about leveling the playing field, about allowing victims whose lives have been forever changed to have the opportunity to be part of the process 100%, not just when it's okay with the perpetrator's attorney.
Liz, how do you counter an argument from victim rights advocates who say that victims do have rights under Pennsylvania law, but they have no recourse if those rights are violated?
Correct. That's right.
Liz?
That's right. Look, I would agree. I think that they could, look, in the statute, they could have some sort of penalty that is applied for an entity that has failed to notify. There could be civil penalties that are applied in that case. That we would not oppose any mechanism that could strengthen the rights of victims in the statute. Our concern, though, is that once you start, if you look at our, so apologies if this gets a little in the constitutional weeds, but if you look at all of our Bill of Rights, each amendment is set up as a protection of the individual against the overreach and the power of the state.
Well, so I think that the victim should be afforded that same.
But here's the problem, Lori. Our concern is that in that mechanism, in that framework, that the rights of the victim in the way that Marcy's Law is written is set up in such a way that it is at the expense of the accused, so that people are recognized in the system in advance when before the person has even been convicted. But
yes,
there's been...
Mm-hmm. The person who is the victim doesn't have a before. They only have an after. And so they have a right to participate and make sure keep their own safety. And that, why should theirs be statutory and the perpetrator is then protected by the Constitution? Statutory can change it any day.
All right.
Well, I'll just say this. They are not perpetrators until there is a conviction. So our concern is that they are accused. This is meant... The framers set these protections up to protect all of us, including those who are innocent. So until someone there's been an established crime and that someone has been convicted of committing that crime, we cannot play fast and loose with having a set of rights that runs headfirst into those rights and really is at the expense of an individual. So that those protections, right to a speedy trial, the presumption of innocence, all those things are potentially undermined by trying to set up a competing set of rights for victims.
But the rights
constitutionally
for speedy
speaking.
Trial are important for victims, too.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking about Marcy's Law, a proposed amendment to Pennsylvania's Constitution that would enshrine the rights of victims. Our guests are Elizabeth Randall of the American Civil Liberties Union and Laurie McDonald, President and CEO of the Center for Victims, based here in Pittsburgh. As we were alluding to, it's not just about notification when a perpetrator is being released from prison, but also notification of court proceedings. Do we have a sense of how often, whether it's the prosecution or whomever is to blame about not notifying the victims about court proceedings? Do we have an idea of how often that happens?
We know that it happens very often. Not only is victim services not afforded the knowledge that a new proceeding is happening, the district attorney's office often is not notified. Mm-hmm. And there's no mechanism to ensure that that happens.
Liz, I wanted to ask you... Go ahead.
I don't know that that's in, Lori, is your understanding that that mechanism is set up in Marcy's Law?
No.
Okay.
I'm just stating a fact.
Okay.
Understood. I agree.
Okay. Liz, I wanted to follow up with you. What does it mean in this legislation, in Marcy's Law, for victims to be considered when determining bail and conditions for release? What is your sense of what that means?
So our concern there is that because at that stage in the process, someone has only been charged or has been arrested, and that one of the paramount presumptions that we enjoy constitutionally is the presumption of innocence. What happens is that if victims are included at that stage, there it then starts to blur that presumption of innocence, that if we recognize the status of a victim that early in the process and that they get to weigh in, that means that person could have been, I think many of us are aware of certainly racial disparities in how people and communities are policed, how people are arrested at different rates, depending on where they live, socioeconomic, et cetera. And so there are people who are certainly arrested and or accused falsely. And even if if it turns out that the person is found guilty, all of those presumptions still need to be in place because, this is the power of the government down on an individual deprive that person
I
of
get that.
Life, liberty,
but
or
the
property.
Government is also bearing down on the rights of the individual who is the victim, the right to be heard, the right to have knowledge, the right to be able to protect themselves.
But how is the state, I'm not sure, Lori, though, how is the state, what is the threat from the state that threatens the victim? What power does the government have to deprive the victim of life, liberty, or property?
There's no constitutional right to have a victim involved in the process of the prosecution of the person who victimized them.
These amendments, similar amendments, are moving across the states, more and more approving voters. Briefly, Liz, what's your reaction to what appears to be a growing trend?
Look, I think that this is an important issue. I think that the concerns that Lori raises are 100% valid. We just believe that this is, our concern with what this is, how this is rolling out nationally. This is a national campaign with model sort of formulaic language. There's a lot that is very vague in that model language that is reproduced in the Pennsylvania amendment.
I think we all understand that, but. It's rolling across the country for a reason, because so many people have been victimized, have had relatives who are victimized. And I think if you work with them every day like I do, if you're one of them, if you're somebody who has been at the other end of this, you feel that pain and you understand how unfair it is for victims to have no knowledge.
All right. We have just 30 seconds.
And I will just say this, that I'm not sure that Marcy's Law provides any remedy for any of the concerns that you just enumerated, Lori. So that's our, and has these other, very huge constitutional concerns. So.
All right. We have just 30 seconds left for each of you. Will your organization take an active role in some sort of campaign to get voters to approve or to reject the ballot question in November? Liz, we're going to start with you. 30 seconds.
Yes, I think, what's important for any constitutional amendment, this is a very serious decision, and we think that voters need to be educated about the issue. And, we would certainly want to make sure that these questions are raised for the public so that they can make an informed decision when they go to the ballot in November.
And Laurie, will the center take an active role in campaigning for approval?
Sure. We already do, because we have so many victims. Even people who work with us who are victims of crime have been victims, have been sitting on the other side of the bench. And, they're very active in this movement because they know what it feels like to not be able to control your own destiny and not to have the knowledge you need. And I think that, to give perpetrators a leg up on the victim, I think most people feel that doesn't ring really fair.
Please.
All right. So we're going to have to leave it there. A reminder that Marcy's Law, the constitutional amendment, goes before voters in Pennsylvania in November. Elizabeth Randall is Legislative Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania. Laurie McDonald is President and CEO of the Center for Victims. Thanks to both of you today.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin. Thanks, Laurie.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, how do you capture the essence of humanity in a 2-inch by 8-inch, 8-ounce work of art? We'll talk with space art pioneer Lowry Burgess, who is leading a team that'll send the mini art museum on a robotic rover to the moon. If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past episodes, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance by Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.